My name is Charles Blue. I'm with the Association for Psychological Science, and we're trying to come up with interesting psychological science perspectives on COVID-19.
Hi, my name is Roxanne Cohen-Silver. I'm a professor of psychological science and medicine and public health at the University of California, Irvine. I'm a social psychologist by training, and my area of expertise is on how individuals and communities cope with disasters.
We've heard so much about the physical and economic element of the COVID-19 pandemic, but the psychological impacts have been no less severe. What would you say are some of the most critical psychological impacts that people are dealing with right now?
Thank you for the question. Many times over the last several decades, our country has been confronted by disasters, both natural and man-made, and we have come through it. Our Americans and people actually across the world are quite resilient, but somehow this particular crisis feels different, and I think it is for several reasons. First, we really have a very ambiguous threat. We really don't know how bad this will get, and we know that the modeling from those who project such things have been all over the map. So because it's so ambiguous, it is particularly stressful. Also, our future is very uncertain. We don't have any idea how long this will last, and many people have been changing the end date, but I think at this point we really have no idea how long our lives are going to be disrupted. It's also an invisible threat. We're getting more and more information suggesting that people who are not showing any symptoms are nonetheless able to infect us, which makes everybody suspect. And also, it's a global threat. There's really no community that's safe. Even individuals who've gone out to the islands in the middle of the Pacific are finding that there are cases. So I think that this makes this event far more stressful and far different from the events that we've encountered and coped with over the last several decades, including 9/11.
That's a rather sobering assessment. And from some of the things you've mentioned, this is not only a bad situation, but it's in a sense a moving goalpost. And the information we have to work with at any given time is changing.
Right.
So I'm thinking, for one instance, at the beginning we were told wearing masks protects others if we're sick, and now it protects us is the latest assessment. What about that? What about if the information is actually changing as the situation evolves? Does that impact us as well?
That really makes this so difficult, I think, to cope with. The very beginning, it seemed as if it was only individuals who were showing symptoms who could transmit this. Then they revised that information. As you said, right now, actually, I have seen conflicting information about whether masks are appropriate or necessary. And that also problematic because we know that there's a shortage of masks for healthcare providers. So we have a lot of competing needs and concerns just about as simple an event as wearing a mask. This is an unfolding crisis as we speak, and each day is different. We also have a variety of other aspects of this crisis that we haven't even discussed, which is the economic fallout, the disruption in our social lives, the disruption in our work lives, the fact that people can no longer engage in their typical forms of worship if that involves going with a community. So in many, many ways, this is very different. And as you clearly indicate, it's unfolding and changing day by day.
Great transition, because I can go into my next question, and that is every generation has gone through some collective crisis, be that world wars, the Great Depression, the Cuban Missile Crisis. But what makes pandemics like COVID-19 and even last century's Spanish flu unique in these generational crises?
That's an excellent question. I think that there are two things that make this so different. One is that in order to protect ourselves and our loved ones, we need to engage in social distancing, or what is now being called physical distancing. And this conflicts with our natural desire to connect with our family and friends, during stressful times. So the cure requires us to suppress our typical ways of coping by being with our friends and loved ones. The second reason why this is different is that our typical sources of distraction, such as engaging in professional or personal sports or going to the gym, going to restaurants or bars or movies or even traveling, are all restricted. And so again, both our typical ways of gaining support from our loved ones and our typical sources of distraction are in direct contradiction to the requirements to protect ourselves and loved ones.
Well, that basically means that the things we would normally do, we can't do. So we're left wondering what we should do. And that kind of brings us to the question of what are the proven techniques? What can psychological science do for us now to reduce the impact as much as possible?
There are several things that I would recommend. First, we know from prior stressful events, large-scale disasters, that it is important to acknowledge that our feelings of stress, our feelings of anxiety, our worry, and our uncertainty are basically normal reactions to this new normal. And I think it's very important that although we might feel at some moments like maybe we're going crazy, I think it's very important to acknowledge that anxiety is appropriate under our current circumstances. In addition, research that my colleagues and I have conducted over the last several decades have made clear that overexposure to the media can amplify the anxiety and the distress that we're feeling. So my strong recommendation is to try to stay informed. I'm not in any way advocating that we avoid the news, but take the news in little chunks. Perhaps check the news a few times a day at most, rather than staying immersed in what is essentially bad news and changing news and sensational reporting of this unfolding disaster.
During these times of stress and times of national disaster, it's often the civic and national leaders who set the tone, help us cope, provide direction. And this doesn't necessarily have to be elected leaders. This could be anyone who we look up to in our community. So what can our leaders, broadly defined, do to help quell our fear and reduce anxiety?
I think one of the most important things that the research that has been conducted on crisis communications tells us is that our leaders should be honest and transparent. Insincerity is very alienating and it leads to distrust. And so I think that empathy from our leaders, honesty from our leaders, and being frank with the uncertainty, not promising more than can be delivered, is likely to help us through this crisis. In contrast, contradictory messages or insincerity are probably going to exacerbate the distress. Moreover, we do know that once trust is lost, it's very difficult to regain it. And therefore, it is extremely important that our leaders be as honest as possible. And that honesty may be simply saying, we don't know. And I think it's okay to say we don't know and we'll tell you as soon as we learn. The science is changing very quickly, and hopefully we'll learn more and more from the virologists and epidemiologists who are studying this crisis. At this point, as you pointed out early on, we have very little information to go on, and the information that we are gaining has been revised over and over again. So I think that it's important that our leaders share with us the reality as they have it at the moment. And if it needs to be revised, that's fine too.
What I found really interesting is that at the very beginning, so much focus in the media was on what do the doctors have to say? What does epidemiology have to say? But now there's a shift, getting so many more requests for the input of psychological scientists. So how is this playing out? Is psychological science proving to be a very helpful added voice to this entire universe of advice we're getting?
There's a couple of different ways in which psychology can contribute to this. One is the kind of research that my colleagues and I do, which is somewhat of an epidemiological approach to looking to see if we can identify factors that are associated with individuals engaging in protective behaviors, or can we understand what is causing the most worry? Can we figure out ways in which we can encourage people to be resilient and to take care of themselves? So there's that kind of more basic science, but also psychological science helps us figure out ways to deliver services to those in need. And many clinicians are shifting now to telehealth, and there's research going on right now to help us understand what are the best ways to deliver that, to deliver therapy to those who need it. I think over time we'll see more and more that we'll need to consider the role of this crisis on our mental health, both at the midterm stage and at the long-term stage. Right now, of course, we're not even yet perhaps in the eye of the storm, so we're still in the acute period. And there are many things that will unfold over time. And I think psychological science and the research that psychological scientists do can certainly help us in this regard.
I'm going to focus on two final questions. First one is basically, if you had a piece of advice you could give to families, specifically families right now who are hunkered down together, what would that be? This is a new situation where parents and children are really locked in together and there's not a lot of opportunity. So what should they be thinking about? What should they be doing?
I think that families should both use this as an opportunity, as you say, to join together, to share their thoughts and feelings about what they're experiencing, but also to allow each individual in the family to have some quiet time, some time alone away from their families where they can reach out to their friends. One of the things we have not yet discussed is the important role of technology. And in fact, we have quite a number of means to communicate with individuals virtually that we didn't have as many as 10 years ago. So I think it's very important that we allow our family members their own time as well as embrace the family time.
We're learning how to do virtual fun.
We really are. Yes, I've seen virtual yoga. I've seen virtual exercise classes, virtual dating. These are all ways in which we can still connect with our friends and our loved ones, even if we can't be with them. And I think we're very lucky to have that capability. We didn't have that capability in the aftermath of 9/11, where people really had to reach out by telephone. Now we have the ability to engage in some sort of video chat, either through their smartphones or their computers. Of course, we have to recognize that not everybody has access to broadband and not everybody has access to computers. And there are many individuals, certainly those who are vulnerable or may have challenging life circumstances right now, that cannot get access to this. So I think we also have to recognize that there are differences across socioeconomic groups. But for many of us, and many people do have smartphones, communicating with loved ones via video is something that we should really embrace.
If you have the ability to get the word out to both colleagues and the public and the media, is there something that really hasn't been brought up that needs to be stressed?
The work that I've been doing with colleagues since the September 11th terrorist attacks tells me the very important role that the media can play in coping with this kind of a crisis. The media serves a very important role in giving us access to accurate information. And I think that it's extremely important that people seek out accurate information. Oftentimes, people are getting information from social media, from posts that they may see from friends or messages that they receive from others. In general, much of the social media posts are not vetted by anybody for accuracy. And so I would be very cautious for people to seek out information from authoritative sources and make sure that they check out the messaging that they're receiving to ensure that it's accurate. And I think that in addition, we want to encourage people not to overindulge in the media. It's very, very difficult to avoid the constant barrage of bad news that we're receiving from every source online and through traditional media right now. But I think it's also very important for people to monitor how much time they're spending immersed in the news about COVID-19 and try to break away, engage in some sort of downtime so that they can cope as best as possible.
I've been talking to Roxanne Cohen-Silver, who is with the Department of Psychological Science at the University of California at Irvine. I thank you very much for your time. This has been Charles Blue with the Association for Psychological Science, and delighted to bring you new information and advice and thoughts as we continue with the COVID-19 situation.